It's Friday, March 22, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Consider these two very different headlines, supposedly about the very same study. First, the headline from yesterday's New York Times: Pediatrics Group Backs Gay Marriage, Saying It Helps Children. Then the headline from the Wall Street Journal: Pediatric Group Views Same-Sex Marriage as Good for Kids. Those two headlines introduce two stories that actually cover the very same report. The press release they're dealing with is a statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics that it believes that the legalization of same-sex marriage is in the best interest of the nation's children. Looking at the two articles, however, and at the two headlines, tells us just how some stories like this are spun in the media, and to what effect. Writing for the Wall Street Journal, reporter Shirley S. Wang wrote, "A major medical group announced its support for same-sex marriage on Thursday, citing evidence suggesting that the health and well-being of the children of gay couples are better when their parents are married," end quote. So in other words, looking at this particular headline, Pediatric Group Views Same-Sex Marriage as Good for Kids, it isn't saying, as you look at the report itself, that same-sex marriage is, in itself, good for kids. What it's saying is that kids are better off when their parents are married. This is a very different story than the headline might seem to indicate. And of course, this is coming at a very interesting time, with the Supreme Court scheduled next week to take up two very important constitutional questions related to the legalization of same-sex marriage. As the Wall Street Journal's report makes clear, the American Academy of Pediatrics identified its interest in the question of same-sex marriage as identifying such factors as potentially better access to health insurance for children of those who are married rather than unmarried when it comes to parents, as well as the legal rights accorded to children and families by marriage, such as parental visitation and custody in case of divorce, end quote. Now, at the first level, perhaps the most interesting aspect of this release is the action taken by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Many parents, and beyond that, many evangelical Christians, are likely to think of the American Academy of Pediatrics as primarily about the physical well-being of children, what they associate as the medical practice and specialization of pediatrics. But over the course of the last 2 to 3 decades, the politicization of medicine has reached the field of pediatrics as well. And pediatricians, in terms of their official guild, the society known as the American Academy of Pediatrics, now have taken on social and cultural issues as well, suggesting, for instance, that progressive and liberal positions on any number of issues will serve the cause of children. Now, if the actual politicization of medicine is some shock to you, just recall the fact that the medical community considered homosexuality a deviation until the years in the early 1970s, when both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association did U-turns on the question of mental illness and homosexuality. Clearly, there's a lot more going on there than medicine, and it is well attested that in both cases, it was a political effort that led to the redefinition of homosexuality. When it comes to this most recent report issued yesterday, indicating that the American Academy of Pediatrics thinks that the legalization of same-sex marriage will be good for children, even some supporters of same-sex marriage believe that the group has gone too far. Scott Altman, a professor who specializes in family law at the University of Southern California's Law School, told the Wall Street Journal that the American Academy of Pediatrics should be cautioned in terms of using the rationale that marriage is necessary for gay parents to receive all the legal rights accorded to heterosexual parents. He, who again himself is a supporter of same-sex marriage, said that in states like California, rights for domestic partners closely mirror those of married couples, end quote. But if you look at the coverage of this same report in the pages of the New York Times, you'll discover that the American Academy of Pediatrics has an answer to Professor Altman's complaint. There in the pages of the Times, reporter Catherine St. Louis suggests that the AAP's position on the legalization of same-sex marriage is also based on the fact that, in the view of the pediatricians included in this group, the legalization of same-sex marriage would be an emotional boost for those who are the children of same-sex couples, legitimizing same-sex relationships by granting them the status of legal marriage. The Times cites Dr. Nanette Gartrell, the lead author of a study, who is a visiting scholar at the University of California, Los Angeles, who said, quote, "Marriage strengthens families and benefits child development, and it also increases a parent's sense of competence and security when they are able to raise children without stigma," end quote. Well, looking at that, you can certainly understand that there is an emotional aspect of this particular report. But the background context is undeniably political. To its credit, the New York Times does draw attention to the very small amount of data that was cited in the research that was supposedly behind this new position statement of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Furthermore, the Times report also cited some within the field of social science who feel that the group has misused this data or has failed to understand that class and economic distinctions have as much to do with the outcomes reported in the research as the issue of the sexuality of parental partners. Earlier this week, we discussed the action taken by Ohio Senator Rob Portman in announcing his newfound support for the legalization of same-sex marriage. We discussed the fact that this represents a new instance of moral relativism, Republican style. That is, the relativizing of a moral principle because there is a relative who actually is involved in the behavior that was once condemned but is now to be legitimated. Now, writing at USA Today, columnist Duane Hickman celebrates what Senator Portman has done. And he offers a very interesting rationale that in many ways I think should be recognized as more honest than that was put forward by Senator Portman himself. Wickham writes, quote, "More than anything else, Portman is a father who was confronted with the dueling commitments to faith and family. In the end, he chose family and son over faith and ideology," end quote. The issue of note here, of course, is the fact that Senator Portman did cite the fact that his own son's homosexuality is what led him to a change in his own position on the legalization of same-sex marriage. The senator, who as a congressman in 1996 had voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, now as a senator is calling for the United States Supreme Court to find the act for which he voted now unconstitutional. He was absolutely unevasive in saying that it was the homosexuality of his son and his desire that his son, who is homosexual, would have the same marital benefits and opportunities of his other two children, a son and daughter, who are heterosexual. Once again, Portman said that it was his son and his son's homosexuality that was the catalyst for the change in his position. But as you will certainly recall, Senator Portman not only cited his son's homosexuality as the catalyst for his change in position, he mentioned that he had wrestled with his faith as well, identifying himself as a Christian. He very clearly stated that he believed that Christianity had taught that marriage was exclusively the union of a man and a woman. But then he said he had found in the scripture overarching themes, he said, of divine love and compassion that led him to change his position. We looked at those arguments quite carefully on Monday's edition of The Briefing. But now Wickham's point is, and I quote, that Portman is a father who was confronted with the dueling commitments to faith and family. In the end, he chose family and son over faith and ideology. Notice that as Duane Wickham is writing his commentary supporting Senator Portman, he seems to think that the obvious reality is that Senator Portman didn't find a way to redefine Christianity, but rather to allow the homosexuality and experience of his son trump biblical and theological concerns. Again, he writes, Portman is a father who is confronted with the dueling commitments to faith and family. In other words, he had to choose between his faith and his family. And Wickham cites approvingly the fact that in the end, Senator Portman chose family and son over faith and ideology. By the way, he ends his column with these words, Portman's tough decision probably will have little short-term effect on the nation's ideological tug of war, but its ripple effects ultimately might help make this nation a better place for people like his son, end quote. Now, we should all be very thankful that Senator Portman and his wife love all three of their children, including their homosexual son. But deciding to redefine marriage and to restructure the central institution of civilization in the light of claiming equal opportunity for one's offspring is simply a bridge too far. On a very different issue, we turn to coverage in the Times of London, where religion correspondent Ruth Gledhill reports with a headline, "Synod will thwart us again, says contender to be woman bishop." As Gledhill reports, even as the Synod of the Church of England narrowly turned down a proposal for the election of female bishops just a matter of months ago, now some of the most prominent women pushing to be bishops are afraid that they'll be thwarted yet once again in the General Synod because they do not expect that their political efforts to push through the proposal for the election of women bishops can succeed, at least under the current composition of the General Synod of the Church of England. As Gledhill reports, the Venerable Rachel Treweek, who is Archdeacon of Hackney and is one of the women considered to be a leading contender to be elected bishop, she has called for a simple single-clause measure to consecrate women to be voted on when the General Synod meets this coming July. But she says she fears that the Synod will not be able to, in her words, square the circle on women bishops with its current makeup. Ah, that's the issue, its current makeup. As Gledhill reports, the Synod is elected by members of deanery synods. Because of strong traditionalist and evangelical representation, the measure to ordain women bishops failed to achieve a two-thirds majority in the House of Laity when it voted last in November. End quote. So what's really going on here? The complaint about the current composition of the General Synod is a complaint about the fact that so many of its members in the House of Laity are democratically elected. And as Ruth Gledhill reports, when the church is able to elect its representatives democratically, it tends to elect a very large number of evangelicals and traditionalists, the people who do not want to vote approvingly of the election of women as bishops. So what those who are pushing now for the election of female bishops in the Church of England, what they're pushing for is a non-democratic option. As Ruth Gledhill reports, quote, "Ms. Treweek is one of an increasing number who believe that the vote to consecrate women will be passed only if the composition of deanery synods is changed." Now, in the arcane and convoluted language of the Church of England, what that means is that the feminists believe they simply can't win if the representatives of the House of Laity in the General Synod continue to be elected by the people in the democratic process. There will have to be some other mechanism, they're now arguing, if they're ever going to have the election of female bishops. But just consider what they're saying. They're complaining that when the democratic process works in terms of electing representatives to the House of Laity and the General Synod, it doesn't look good for those who are pushing for the consecration of female bishops. So, as the Times well recognizes, when those who are pushing for the consecration of women bishops use language complaining about the, quote, current composition, end quote, of the House of Laity, what they're really saying is they want far less democracy than they've got, which in the Church of England isn't, after all, that much. Remember that the proposal to consecrate women bishops passed in the House of the Bishops and actually came close to passing in the House of the Laity, but the democratic process prevented that. And now there are at least some honest agents in the Church of England who will admit they're frustrated, if not exasperated, with democracy. One final note on this story. The reason why so many traditionalists and evangelicals are elected through this process is because, now note this carefully, it is traditionalists and evangelicals who tend to show up at church and thus to be able to show up to vote. Go figure. Finally, if you read the front page of yesterday's edition of USA Today, you saw this headline, "United Nations, come on, get happy." Natalie DeBlasio, reporting for USA Today, writes, "Did a stranger give you a free hug on Wednesday? You aren't alone. The United Nations declared March 20 as the first International Day of Happiness. Its official reasoning? To encourage countries to, quote, better capture the importance of the pursuit of happiness and well-being in development with a view to guiding their public policies," end quote. De Blasio goes on to write, "It's just one of many United Nations observances. For instance, the UN has designated special days for poetry, seafarers, rabies, rural women, malaria, jazz, and migratory birds," end quote. To paraphrase the reporter, she could just as well have written, "It's just one of many United Nations observances that almost every nation in the world roundly, unanimously ignores." Nevertheless, the event yesterday did get at least some attention around the world, with people suggesting that what nations should strive for and governments should be held accountable to is the happiness of their people. Something that should be noted here is, by the way, the fact that even as happiness is very much a part of the founding ethos of our country, the American understanding of this happiness is the pursuit of happiness, not the realization of it. In other words, our founding fathers and mothers believed that the best government is the one that allows its citizens to pursue their own happiness, not the understanding that the government had the responsibility to make us happy. Leave it to the United Nations to come up with the idea that governments should be held accountable in terms of how happy they make their people. You know, this is where the founding fathers and mothers of our country understood something very basic to human nature. This is something that Christians must understand even at a deeper level. Human beings do not have the same concerns for happiness. The same things do not make all people happy, and many people will not be made happy by that which would make another person extremely happy. One person's happiness might be another person's profound unhappiness. The American experiment has been based on an individual's right and responsibility to pursue happiness. That's a very different thing than believing that government, at either the national or, for that matter, the international level, can come up with a definition of human happiness, and it's an even greater idolatry of government to believe that government could deliver on that promise. One of the most ridiculous things we might read in the history of political thought is the fact that a nation has the responsibility to make its people happy. How in the world could it deliver on that promise? But wait just a moment. Perhaps in a secularizing society, in a world that no longer believes that there are any transcendent realities, that there is any theistic reality that can bring happiness, perhaps government is all that is left. Perhaps our society has truly become so secularized that only government seems to be powerful enough to deliver happiness. But government may be powerful, but it isn't powerful enough to deliver happiness. And furthermore, most ominously, any government that comes up with a boilerplate understanding of what would make for happiness and would then seek to enforce that happiness on its people is going to bring about profound unfreedom and unhappiness as well. But as a final thought, perhaps if yesterday you felt a little guilty for feeling unhappy, maybe it's because you let down not only yourself, but you now know the entire United Nations as well. Are you happy about that? Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.